This is The Real Story from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay with your weekly in-depth look at a story making news around the world. And this week, whistleblowers. Why is it still so hard to speak out? Just this year, there have been a series of cases where insiders called out activity they felt the public should know about. Hospitals failing to care enough. What the Pentagon knows about UFOs. And massive fraud at the tech startup company Theranos.
It was a group of clinicians following a process, trying to raise concerns and having our concerns turned on their head.
Do we have the bodies of the pilots who piloted this craft?
As I've stated publicly already in my News Nation interview, biologics came with some of these recoveries, yeah.
Were they, I guess, human or non-human biologics?
Non-human, and that was the assessment of people with direct knowledge on the program I talked to.
They tried to isolate me from my family. Elizabeth was trying to convince my grandparents and my parents that I was the crazy one.
Exposing wrongdoing may not prevent whistleblowers being ostracized and traumatized.
I haven't been able to get a job since then. I've become, call it a professional whistleblower, not by choice. Financially, I've reached ruin. The trauma of what I went through took its toll on my marriage, so subsequently I got divorced. It's been horrible. It's been absolutely horrible, and it's certainly not something that I would wish on anybody.
It's hard then for those who do speak out. But why, in the face of wrongdoing, do some of those who should want to know the truth and who have the power to make things better instead choose to look away?
We all turn a blind eye to live our lives the way that we do. We know lots of our clothes and some of the commodities we have are probably made through exploited labour rules. And we all turn a blind eye to some extent to participate in our society. I can quite understand why people whose jobs may be on the line, who are very successful, do not want to accept that their success is built to some extent on corruption.
Would a greater level of protection and support encourage more people to come forward to expose the truth?
When they're confronted with hard truths that whistleblowers provide, the instinct, instead of embracing that person and saying, thank you for being the canary in the coal mine, telling us about the risk, they have the opposite reaction.
Whistleblowers may help to let the sun shine in, but that doesn't mean they're always right.
Whistleblowing is about the human right to freedom of expression. There are other human rights, the right to privacy, right to data protection. Whistleblowing involves a careful balance. There is collateral damage. Somebody has a reasonable suspicion. Inevitably, if they don't have the evidence, it may turn out that they're wrong.
Blowing the whistle on your employer may also blow the whistle on your career. Why does it take such a toll on those who speak out? Why is there still so much resistance from employers? And should whistleblowing, in fact, be a duty on all of us? So how can the work culture be changed to empower whistleblowers and to make those who employ them grateful for the noise? Just one of the questions the Real Story panel will be trying to answer over the next hour. This week, we welcome Anna Myers, director of the Whistleblowing International Network, which supports non-government bodies who themselves try to help those who are seeking to expose wrongdoing. Anna's in Glasgow here in the UK. Anna, welcome. How do you define whistleblowing?
One of the sort of most straightforward definitions I know of is a person or persons who come across suspected wrongdoing or a risk of harm, most typically within the workplace, and they raise it or disclose that information to someone who should or could do something about it.
Thank you. In Washington, D.C. is Kyle Welsh. Kyle is assistant professor at the George Washington University School of Business. He studied whether whistleblowing inside companies can actually help them. Kyle, welcome. In what ways do we misunderstand whistleblowing, do you think?
Whistleblowing happens a lot. If you look at reports and surveys based on where we uncover fraud and problems, this is the best tool humanity has in uncovering any type of problem or fraud. And you talk to anybody that does it, internal audit, they say, how did they discover the problem during their internal audit? It's usually from talking to humans. Unfortunately, the stories we hear about are all examples of failures of whistleblowing. And the successful whistleblowing, we usually don't end up hearing about a lot of times, because if it happens at a corporation, a manager responds to it, fixes it, and it gets resolved. And we don't have a lot of disclosures on it. Imagine this. It would be as if you formed an opinion about whistleblowing based only on all the negatives. So if you formed an opinion of driving a car from only hanging out in an emergency room, you wouldn't get a good opinion about how to drive a car, how risky it was. And that's kind of what we have with whistleblowing, is that we only see the ER room type situations that make it in the press or in lawsuits. And that's a problem.
Carl, thank you very much. And also with us on the panel is Narinder Kapoor, Professor of Neuropsychology at University College London. In 2010, he blew the whistle over concerns about patient care and safety at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, where he was then head of neuropsychology. Narinder, welcome. As someone who's blown the whistle, how do you define it?
Well, I think that there are a number of definitions out there. And I suppose if you want a really broad one, it's somebody who, in the public interest, has a reasonable belief that something unsatisfactory is going on. It could be in the workplace, it could be in other situations, and that unsatisfactory activity could be somebody breaking the law or unfairness taking place, or it could be something which affects the health and safety of people. And then in theory, it has to be in the public interest as well, the concerns that are being raised. So I think that's a sort of a broad definition, I think.
Yeah, we'll come back to the public interest point a little later. Thank you all very much. Now, a series of high-profile scandals in the UK's National Health Service don't appear to have diminished public support for the service, which is free at the point of use. Yet despite assurances of change in a culture which seemed to cover up failure, the conviction last month of a nurse who murdered babies in her care suggests that not enough has changed. At her trial, Letby was found guilty of 7 murders and 6 more attempted murders. Worse still has been the realisation that 2 of her victims may not have died if the concerns hadn't been ignored, and the doctors raising them rebuked and even ordered to apologise to the nurse involved. Lucy Letby worked on a neonatal unit in England. Dr. Stephen Breary, the lead consultant on the unit, raised concerns in October 2015. Whilst no one knew she was killing or trying to kill some of those in her care, Dr. Breary hoped his concerns and those of, in the end, 7 of his fellow senior doctors would be taken seriously. Instead, senior managers at the Countess of Chester Hospital seemed to him to be focused on the potential of reputational damage to the organisation and were, for some time, reluctant to involve the police. So why weren't Dr. Breary and his colleagues listened to? This is what he told the BBC after Letby was sent to jail and told she will never be freed.
It was a group of clinicians following a process trying to raise concerns and having our concerns turned on their head. And I think, you know, our experiences aren't uncommon in the NHS, that you go to senior colleagues with a problem and you come away confused and anxious because that problem is being turned in a way in which you start to realise that they're seeing you as a problem rather than the concern that you have.
And when you say it's not uncommon in the NHS, do you think that culture still exists at other hospital trusts?
Well, it's, you know, it's difficult to generalise completely.
But you obviously talk to and know doctors in other places. I mean, do you have a sense that there has been a cultural change or not?
Well, I've spoken to a number of different clinicians around the country, not just in paediatrics, and I really think our experiences aren't unusual. And I've also received correspondence just in the last 3 days from various people around the country saying similar things.
Saying that,
you know, obviously sometimes it wasn't quite the magnitude of concern that we had with our case, but that clinicians raised concerns with senior members of the hospital, and their lives were made very difficult by doing that. And I can't emphasize enough how difficult and what a difficult position that puts the clinician in, because not only do they feel the issue isn't being addressed, but they also feel under attack and going to work every day and carrying out your clinical practice in that environment is very difficult.
When you talk to people, what is the motive that they believe that the executives, that those in charge, that those in some cases who are not listening, what is their motive in not listening?
What's often put to us and what's been put out in our case is a sort of fear of reputational damage. for the organisation. I suspect underlying that is probably a fear of individual reputational damage as well. And that may well be being used as a proxy, calling it a trust organisational concern. And that was certainly put to us when we were raising our concerns, that they felt the reputation of the trust would be damaged. Quite often we'll see senior managers who have no apparent accountability for what they do in our trusts and then move to other trusts. And, you worry about their future actions.
It's Dr. Stephen Breary talking to Justin Webb from the BBC. Well, in a statement for this programme, an NHS spokesman told us it is absolutely vital that everyone working in the NHS feels they can raise concerns and that these concerns are acted on. And we have reminded NHS leaders about the importance of this following the verdict last week. Every health service trust is expected to adopt an updated national freedom to speak up policy, and we've asked them to urgently ensure staff have easy access to information on how they can raise their concerns. Narinder Kapoor, it seems particularly disturbing that clinicians in a unit dealing with patients whose lives were medically vulnerable anyway were ignored. Can you understand why that might have happened?
One can understand it to some extent. I mean, you have a number of things going on. As the person who's interviewed pointed out, the senior people in the organisation may be concerned about the reputation of the organisation. That's number one. Number two, you have a situation where managers who are not accountable. They're not regulated. I'm regulated, doctors are regulated, nurses are regulated, but managers are not regulated. So in a sense, they've got the freedom to do what they want and they can get away with it. But you can also sometimes get differences between staff. So for example, in the case of Nurse Willetby, the nursing officer was sort of supporting her, but the doctors were expressing concern. And so you may have had a slight conflict there, the doctor saying one thing, nurses saying something else, and you may have then a confrontation or a collision between the two professions. So I think it may be a multifactorial as to why they weren't listened to.
Anna Myers at the Whistleblowing International Network, who's on the line from Glasgow, one of the clinicians whose complaint was rebuffed, told the BBC he now wishes he'd become an external whistleblower and gone straight to the police. Is it reasonable, do you think, for the public to expect that those who've been rebuffed internally will do just that, not necessarily the police, but will go to an external body and carry on their campaign?
I think what is so interesting is that when you look back, the reviews of what happened in the Letby case and you see what the doctors were doing, overall, it seems pretty obvious in hindsight that there was a problem and it should have been looked at dispassionately and quickly, especially when it's a patient safety issue and babies. And I think the issue about going externally is you want the accountability mechanisms to work. This is what whistleblowing really is about. And I think Kyle mentioned at the beginning, we only really hear about it when it goes wrong. I don't think it's about the whistleblowing going wrong. It's showing that the accountability mechanisms that we've set up are not working. And that's the question that needs to be answered. Unfortunately, the focus is on the messenger rather than the message.
Well, whistleblowing is defined here in the UK as the act of an employee raising a concern about an alleged wrongdoing, including corrupt, illegal or unethical behaviours in a public or private sector organisation. However, to enjoy legal protection against being fired or prosecuted, it must be in the public interest to reveal the information, meaning others must be affected. You can't just blow the whistle for private gain. Ralph Nader, a famous civic activist in the United States and four-time presidential candidate, is said to have popularised the phrase there in the early 1970s because he didn't like the negative connotations of the alternatives, including informer and snitch. Carl Welsh, you do research in this area in the United States. How helpful or not is this label whistleblower, do you think?
I think it's fine. If you talk to the average person that does speak up, they don't see themselves as a whistleblower or a hero. What they see themselves as somebody just doing their job. And they feel a sense of morality to something going wrong and making things or trying to make things right. People don't want to work at companies that do things wrong, that are handling things wrong. It sounds like a horrible human capital experience to be in that. And so a lot of times companies will label it internally as a hotline or a helpline. And, you know, there's good and bad with those labels, because you end up getting, if you get a helpline, you get people saying, I didn't get enough donuts on donut day type of thing coming through the system. But also you kind of enable a little bit more speaking up for problems. And that is a key thing to have. And I just say, you know, the organizations that have problems with this are clueless on how valuable this tool can be in so many ways for their organization, from human capital retention to solving the big problems. I mean, we're talking about the extreme of like people's lives and kids, you know, passing in medical care. But there's also some amazing carrots with this as far as employees feeling like they have an impact, that they'll be heard, that if they see a problem, the employer will respond, does huge value to an organization. That's hard to measure, but is there. And I would say labeling it, anything you can do to train on it, label it, and making employees feel like they'll be protected and they will be heard is super, super important for effective systems.
Bad men, John Stuart Mill, the politician and philosopher, is said to have told a university audience in 1867, need nothing more to compass their ends than that good men should look on and do nothing. But whistleblowing is not always black and white. Some whistleblowers could be motivated by malice, whilst those being exposed needn't necessarily realise that they're doing something wrong. Take a listen to David Lewis, who is Professor of Employment Law at Middlesex University.
Whistleblowing is about the human right to freedom of expression. There are other human rights, the right to privacy, right to data protection. Whistleblowing involves a careful balance, and the EU has taken a lot of care over this. There is collateral damage. Somebody has a reasonable suspicion. Inevitably, if they don't have the evidence, it may turn out that they're wrong. That's why, as a professor of employment law, I feel very strongly about the duty of employers to take allegations seriously, but to engage in screening and ask themselves, is this credible? Is an allegation being made against somebody who couldn't possibly be guilty of this wrongdoing? So it is a question of balancing. When there's evidence that somebody's deliberately supplied false information, that needs to be dealt with in a very serious fashion.
Narinda, is it fair to say that people have different views inside a health system about what constitutes right and wrong? That maybe some things that aren't officially approved, they think, well, they're okay because they actually help us do the work?
Yeah, you're right. You get situations where they may be using procedures and policies which may save money. And if that saves money for the organization, even though they're breaking rules and maybe endangering patient care, well, look, they may say, well, look, it's saving our money. I mean, in my own case, they would often deny, well, you're not really a whistleblower. And even though in my case, they set up an internal inquiry and that showed that I was right, and they changed their practice of using unqualified staff in clinics, which I pointed out was endangering patient care. And when I was dismissed, you know, that was just played down. I think they'll give all sorts of reasons for playing down the concerns that the person's doing, and then playing down the aberrant behaviours as well, saying, oh, those were just minor. Unfortunately, you have that sort of thing going on.
I should say, Professor Kapoor, that in the case of your dismissal, an employment tribunal ruled you had been unfairly dismissed, but not because you were a whistleblower, although the tribunal recognised you as such. Carl, did you want to come in at that point? Carl Welsh in the United States.
Yeah, just to add on that, this is a common critique of, you know, these systems. And yeah, the reality is there. To use the car example, it's kind of about complaining that you have to fill up your car with petrol, right? Yeah, you do, but it's super effective in your life. And if you look at these, if you look at whistleblowing systems, yes, you're going to get people that misuse it. Somebody that might be online to being sacked, they can read the writing on the wall. What they might do is put a tip in the system to try to protect themselves and say, oh, they fired me because I did. All these things happen, and it doesn't matter. This tool is too effective. Like it is, I mean, you think about all the effort we spend on accounting inside of every organization. Mm-hmm. This tool uncovers like a multiple of 5 times what an accounting system uncovers in reporting and identifying problems and fraud and waste and abuse. There is nothing that comes close to it. Yeah, we're going to get problems, but guess what? you have no idea the efficacy of these systems. They are so effective at uncovering problems. You're throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you spend all your time focusing on these things. Yeah, there can be frivolous claims. There's always going to be that type of thing. Even on the frivolous claims, sometimes somebody's doing an interview and they're just testing the system to see if that somebody will actually listen to them. And then after the interview, oh my gosh, they'll dish and they'll tell you everything.
Anna Moore.
Yeah, I just think it's really important to think at two things that have come up in just in what Narinder Kapoor was saying. He was raising things and they changed it because it made sense. He was part of a solution. And what Kyle is saying is when you are open to hearing, because you're looking at the message, it becomes easier to deal with what are minor issues and deal with those properly and be clear. And if somebody is putting something in that is wrong, then you can address it and deal with it. And you can be very strong in your response or feel confident as an employer. And I think one of the things that some of the systems that I've seen set up around the world have done is started to say, you know, give us the information. Bye-bye. And as Kyle points out, sometimes people need to test the system. Sometimes they will want to stay anonymous till they know that actually something will be done. And it is really up to the employers, the organizations, the regulators to be clear about what their role is to help people raise these issues so that they can be addressed if there is a problem and so that they can also feel reassured if there is not. And I think the other thing that I wanted to point out is that this issue of protection is a really important one. But when you talk to people, and I was on an advice line for many years, you know that what they really want is to make a difference. They want it to be addressed. That's why they're in this situation. They clearly might be reacting to what is happening to them, and so they need help with that. But if you said to them, we'll protect you, you'll never have to worry about this, but we won't deal with it, they'll say, no, that's not why I put myself in this position. I need it to be addressed. So I think if organizations around the world understood that, as Kyle says, this is your information, that this is such a valuable tool, then they, if they see these people, even if difficult at the start, because there may be mistrust that's built up in terms of they've been raising it before, and then they try the system and they're already a little bit concerned about how it's going to be addressed, they may not always be the best messenger. But the idea they have to do it perfectly is a craziness. And I think we need to really see this as something that's a positive thing for us to get on with our lives, to know that our children are safe going to school, that the food that we eat in the supermarkets are safe. You know, I don't want to rely only on individuals having to take big risks and for all the focus to be on them. I want us to look together at what they are saying and come up with a solution.
A reminder, you're listening to The Real Story from the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. This week, why do whistleblowers often get punished even when they're doing the right thing? In the commercial world, is it legitimate to worry about reputational damage? Managers may fear that whistleblowing is bad for the bottom line, but are they right? Is whistleblowing sometimes an act of malice? Well, the UK's National Health Service has had its fair share of whistleblowers and accusations of cover-ups, but it's far from alone. All over the world, public and private organisations have had all types of wrongdoing and unlawful activity exposed by whistleblowers in recent years, from car manufacturers to tech startups like Theranos to social media giants. But for those who speak out in the field of national security, it may not be their job that's at risk. Their liberty can be too. Thomas Drake is a former senior executive at the National Security Agency, the United States Electronic Espionage Service. In 2006, his attempts to report to his superiors and to regulators that billions of dollars were being wasted were rebuffed. He leaked information to a newspaper about the wasteful spending and about illegal surveillance of US citizens, and he was charged with crimes under the Espionage Act.
I was confronted with the reality that after 9/11 in particular, the United States decided to engage in a secret surveillance regime, bypassing the constitutional restraints and existing law, particularly the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, in the name of national security.
You raised that internally. You tried to say to your managers what's going on.
That and a number of things, including the 9/11 intelligence failure based on knowledge and information that was already available, and also massive fraud, waste, and abuse in terms of billions and billions of dollars being spent.
What was the reaction?
institutions don't appreciate, especially secret institutions, don't appreciate being questioned even internally, even though there's mechanisms that are supposed to provide oversight, and they push back. There was a lot of resistance to any kind of exposure, even internally, and that went on for several years.
You were being treated badly as a result of this? Was it just they said, no, we're not interested, get on with your job?
Anytime you poke power, especially when the power is abused, it tends to push back. And people didn't like the fact that I was raising and asking very uncomfortable questions about certain behaviors that had been approved at the highest levels of the government, as well as the highest levels of NSA. The retaliation began early on.
Did you feel like you were being punished?
By definition, I was being punished because I was, quote unquote, you know, not a team player. I was speaking out of turn. I was supposed to keep silent, as it were.
Was that a factor in your ultimate decision to go to a newspaper?
In part, it was. It was ultimately a choice, you say, of sort of the moral dilemma. But the dilemma was I couldn't remain silent, given that I had not just a fiduciary responsibility, but I had an accountability to the American public, even though I was inside of a secret organization. And so I made a choice after a number of years of going through all channels, whistleblower channels and oversight channels that existed, including congressional oversight channels. I made a fateful choice to go to the press. I mean, some of that's the ultimate check on abuse of power in government, is especially in the U.S., or any democracy, is you go to the press. But I knew by going to the press, it was a fateful choice. They would have no doubt intended consequences, meaning they would react quite severely once it was determined that I had gone to the press.
Were you expecting the reaction to be so severe, by which I mean charges under the Espionage Act?
I did anticipate that. This was eyes wide open. There's no innocence here or naivete. I had grown up as a very, you know, young teenager during the Pentagon Papers, Watergate, Ellsberg era.
This is Daniel Ellsberg, who died recently.
Daniel Ellsberg. I knew going to the press was fraught with peril. I knew, as we say, it's touching the third rail, that the government was not going to react too kindly, especially when there had been executive decisions made about the surveillance regime in particular, all the way up to and including the President of the United States. So they weren't going to take too kindly to somebody like me going to the press with extremely uncomfortable information.
Now, ultimately, albeit just 4 days before you were due in court, those charges were dropped. And in the end, you were convicted on a much more minor charge, I think, of using a government computer longer than you were authorized to, or something like that.
Thank you. Exceeding authorized use of a government computer. It was based on my terms, it was an off-ramp where I would remain free, even though I was under 1 year probation and 240 hours of community service. That was the penalty.
Given what happened subsequently, the fact that you effectively became unemployable in your chosen field, the thing you were passionate and cared so much about, would you do it again?
Well, yes, I would do it again. I probably would have gone to the press sooner knowing what happened.
Thomas Drake there talking to me from the United States a little earlier. Anna Myers, what is going on in organizations that seem to prevent or resist listening to concerns raised by their own employees?
Yeah, I think it's a minefield in one way. I think once there's a sort of decision made by someone along the line that, you know, this isn't something we need to handle, there's often a kind of groupthink that starts to happen. I also think that in organizations are really, they're used to controlling their information, and they may want to know a lot about what's going on, which is lower level. But if it comes up to the level of senior management or the decisions made at the top of the organization, then you're really calling into question their decision making and their judgment, and you can get a very almost personal response. And I think that that's where, again, we have to get right back to the accountability mechanisms. That's why laws do protect. And again, these aren't easy cases. And it's really helpful if people can get early advice from someone who's helping them both within a legal environment to work out their own position, but importantly, are also trying to help them get the issue addressed and see it as an issue. And I think that's where people should be able to go outside directly to, you know, regulatory authorities, that it's part of their job to be regulating the sector or the industry, like the Financial Conduct Authority. And they should be able to go directly there because that is, they have actual powers to investigate. And ultimately, it's the public that calls to account governments and private sector. And so you do need to have the freedom of expression rights. And it's not just about my personal right to an opinion, it's actually about the public's right to know. And so when we have these national security cases, I mean, I know with Thomas Drake, he went to the inspector generals. That is a system for personnel to go to. But in some cases, if that can be a trap for them. And you need the exit ramps. You need to be able to have, in a democracy, the ability to go elsewhere and ultimately to journalism. That's a really important part of the public having the information that it needs to make these decisions. Whistleblower laws can help clarify the boundaries of secrecy, but my God, you need help navigating that.
Kyle Welsh in Washington. Brookhouse Derringer, the large company that does a lot of work in this area, found that nearly 30% of managers in a survey they conducted in 2014 reported that their company actively discouraged whistleblowing. I wonder how you turn that perception around, that you create a sense for companies that this is actually a good thing.
It's really just education. One of these things that's really hard for people to kind of get and understand is that this feedback is so valuable for companies. And it is so much better to have the feedback come via this way and respond to it than the other way. We've done a couple of academic papers using data from Navex Global, which is the largest provider of these internal systems. And the data is clear on this. I mean, it is crystal clear. If you have one of these systems, and the more active the system is, the fewer fines you have, the fewer lawsuits you have, the lower settlement amount. And it's like, just on a univariate regression from it, we do a multi-factor regression, but just on a univariate regression, you see that, you know, the difference between somebody that has an active system versus one that doesn't, they avoid millions in fines. And unfortunately, we can only measure the negative side. We can't measure the upside. The upside is that you have employees that don't, you know, post for jobs and transition and leave your company, causing a brain drain because they just don't like the culture. Without question, the biggest thing is education, because a lot of people in management don't look at like having more complaints in a system and seeing it as a good thing. But the reality is, it is. All the data says it is. It's kind of like being a family at dinner that never talks versus the family that talks and knows about everybody's problems that they're dealing with. I'd much rather be in the latter family, because guess what? That family can help each other out. And that's exactly what's supposed to happen in a business. You're never going to have a business that has zero problems, because we always have humans in our businesses.
Professor Narinda Kapoor in the UK, there have been efforts in the National Health Service, repeated efforts, to create a culture where people have the freedom to speak up. There's even talk of creating advocates to help that process. I mean, the NHS would like to think of itself, to use Carl Welsh's analogy, as being a family. Why do you think maybe public organisations that are there with a very good view of themselves and don't have to worry about their profitability, why don't they seem able to embrace this culture or not do so yet?
In theory, we had this freedom to speak up national guardian system, which was introduced about 6 or 7 years ago. And that has clearly failed. The last two staff surveys, which has been done in the NHS in the last few years, shows that NHS staff still don't feel confident about speaking up. So that particular system needs to be overhauled. You know, something simple like these so-called freedom to speak up guardians are actually employees of the organisation, and they should be external to the organisation. But I think as to why there's still a persistent problem in the NHS, well, why these public organisations still have these issues, well, I think, as I said, I think there's a number of factors going on. People are concerned about their reputation, the lack of accountability for the managers there. And I think that whenever people do raise concerns, they're regarded as threats and things like that. So, and the other thing is that regulatory bodies have to look at things differently, because it's often, you know, nurses and doctors in management roles who sometimes misbehave. And so regulatory bodies need to look at doctors and nurses when they take on management roles.
There is what one observer calls a sword and shield problem with whistleblowing. You may not be able to defend yourself, for example, from being sacked, but you can invoke legal support afterwards to get compensation. It's clear, though, that exposing the truth can cost you your career and more. Take the case of South African businesswoman Bianca Goodson. She used to be the chief executive officer of the investment firm Trillium. It was linked to the influential Gupta family. They had a friend in high places, in fact, the highest place of all, the presidency, Jacob Zuma. Bianca and others went public with their claims of what an inquiry later determined was state capture, businesses and politicians conspiring to influence a country's decision-making process to advance their own personal interests. The Gupta family, Trillion, and former South African President Jacob Zuma all deny any wrongdoing. Bianca and her fellow whistleblowers in this case believe they did the right thing, but she's spoken in the past of the ongoing price she's paid.
I haven't been able to get a job since then. I've become a public figure. I mean, this may sound really funny, but at the moment I'm Googleable, right? I never used to be Googleable. I've become, call it a professional whistleblower, not by choice. So that's what's happened to my life. In my personal life, I've struggled. Financially, I've reached ruin. Because I couldn't find employment for such a long time, I had to release my pension to support my daughter and I. Now I'm supported, I'm 40 years old and I'm supported by my parents. The trauma of what I went through took its toll on my marriage. So subsequently I got divorced. It's been horrible. It's been absolutely horrible. And it's certainly not something that I would wish on anybody. Nobody says it to my face, but the impression that I get is that I'm a bit of a troublemaker. I rock the boat. And it's disturbing because I had a completely unblemished career. You know, my skills and my competence hasn't changed. What I was able to do from my career from my 20s all the way to my late 30s, I haven't lost the capability in any way, and yet I find myself completely unemployable. It's illogical to me. Since I've started looking, actively looking, which I've got at least 2,500 job applications out there, I haven't had a single positive response. It's so bizarre. And you get these people, chairmen of boards, for example, that would say things like, you know, you'd be an asset to any company. You're so brave. You've got such unquestionable integrity. You get people saying all these wonderful things to you, but as soon as you send them your CV, you get a whole bunch of excuses.
South African whistleblower Bianca Goodson. Anna Myers, is there enough protection and support in place for whistleblowers like Bianca?
The Whistleblowing International Network, our membership organizations are made up of national NGOs, nonprofit organizations that provide access to legal advice and are public interest oriented, so that have some dedication to whistleblowing. There's only about 14 of those around the world that people can get early advice about what to do and address that. There are lawyers, particularly in the US, because of the reward systems that they have and some of the compensation and lawyers being able to recoup their fees, that they have more access to legal advice. And I think that the laws are starting, you mentioned, or it was mentioned in the intro, about how there's this sort of disconnect between protections, which are after the fact, which law as a lawyer, I'm very well aware they come in often after the fact, and the fact that they're looking at remedying a situation for the individual. They're not actually looking at the concern. So there's a couple of things that we're seeing internationally that are starting to change in the legal protections or frameworks. They're starting to put duties on employers to set up systems. So the European Union has passed a directive, which of course doesn't apply to the UK. And that has started to put in these duties on employers and regulators, including confidentiality and disclosing and putting some sanctions against those who disclose someone's identity without their consent. And then we're seeing certain laws, like in the Treasury law amendments in Australia, which are corporate laws, they're starting to put a duty of care in. So you can see that there's sort of slowly but surely starting to be understanding that this isn't about the individual breakdown. That's about remedying a harm done to a whistleblower. And those are very important. But whistleblowing laws, that's, you know, you would hope that would have prompted employers to say, well, we don't want to face those laws or those claims, and so we'll address it. But in fact, they have so many other interests that play, like shareholders, and that reputational risk, which can have a direct impact on their share prices, and fear about that, and to the public and to regulators. So they might not see an individual whistleblower claim in the wider perspective as that much of a deterrent. So I do think we're starting to see a switch in looking at actually holding the organizations to account not only for whether they address the wrongdoing, but actually how they're actually putting in systems to protect whistleblowers and if they're doing it right and doing it before there's a whistleblower. Like, what do you have in place? And can you tell us about that? I just wanted to say one more thing. In the UK, we have Jess Staley, who of course now his reputation is gone, but when he was head of Barclays, he ended up paying, I think it was like something like £640,000 fine to the Financial Conduct Authority because he wanted to unmask a whistleblower who had gone through their internal systems. And in wanting to do that and finding out who done it, basically, even though the issue had been addressed through the system, he was undermining the entire system for the bank, and he thought he could do that.
Just picking up on the mention of an EU directive there, that was due to be introduced in all 27 member countries by 2021. It hasn't quite managed that yet, but it clearly is in the process. I just wonder, Carl Welsh, how does the EU compare with the United States? What legal protection and support for whistleblowers exists where you are?
The laws, you could argue, are stronger in the EU in some ways, and the protections are stronger in some ways. The key to this is not the laws. Laws are helpful. They are absolutely helpful for changing things. But if you're going to get anything, it's culture. And the culture has to change. And it is. It is changing. I don't think we have more fraud now than we have in any point in history. What we have now is the ability for individuals' voices to be heard much better than ever in the past. The internet, online, a voice can be heard and somebody speaking up can be heard. And so I think what's happening now is we're living in a time where we're realizing how corrupt society can be and organizations can be. And so with that, in order for it to be effective to be a whistleblower, you need the laws, but most importantly, you need that culture. And something that the U.S. has done well is we've just been really good at complaining about things, I think, or just speaking up about problems. And so in the United States, it's very different than most other cultures around the world, where people don't want to stick out of the crowd. They don't want to raise their voice. There's a tendency to not do that culturally. When you look at these systems across all these different nations and the level of reports per employee, we know problems are going on everywhere. It's just that some places people are more willing to speak up. So if I was to get anything, it would be the laws, but then a focus on culture. The management is simply just not getting it in some cases, that this is a valuable tool. It's not a threat.
Just on the point of what's happening in the United States, I mean, there are other approaches as well, aren't there? I mean, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, actually kind of incentivizes tips. So if you tip them off, you blow the whistle, you can get quite a lot of money. Somebody back in May, I think, earned $279 million as a single tip off.
It's not just the Securities Exchange Commission, although that's the one that's gotten a lot of news. It's any business that does any transactions with the government. And it started after the Civil War in the United States. If you actually can identify that someone is defrauding the government from healthcare, you know, Medicaid, healthcare programs, all the way to military contracts, there are big fines. And with those fines, if you help the government identify this fraud, waste, and abuse, you actually get a reward. So that's one aspect. So I think that aspect is very helpful. But there's something that's done here that I think is a pretty good balance. With the Securities Exchange Commission, in order to get a handsome reward, what you need to do is you need to report it internally first. You can get a reward if you don't report it internally, but when you report it, and like 85-90% of the people go internally first anyway, but your reward is higher if you actually give the company an opportunity to do it. Because what you don't want is a nation state that's getting all these tips that has to go out and pursue all these. Most problems, going back to the family analogy, most problems are best handled inside of family. Sometimes you need to get the government involved because there's something atrocious going on. But generally speaking, giving managers and leaders the opportunity to fix it internally first is I think a great approach. Alternatively, we haven't seen the other end of this, is that if you get a tip, it seems like there should be some sort of liability associated with being a manager that squashes a tip. Or
Professor Kapoor, what would you have liked to have happened when you made your complaint, first of all? What was your expectation, your hope?
Well, obviously, I was hoping that obviously things would change, and that the concerns that I expressed, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's our responsibility in a job like mine to look after patients. And so I would have hoped that all the concerns I had would have been addressed. But also, it's the, as people said, the culture, the behavior of people in authority, people who did wrong. You know, you'd want those changes to take place. I mean, I did actually go back to the hospital two years ago. I met the current HR director and chief executive, and I asked, you know, for an apology for what I went through and for changes to the system. And they refused to give an apology, even though they realised what they did wrong. And even I said, are there now changes to the system so that what happened to me would never happen to anybody else? And I just got a waffle in the response, a waffle. There's still flaws in the system, unfortunately.
That's one reason, perhaps, to be pessimistic about the future. I wonder if there are, though, reasons to be more hopeful. Carl Welsh in the United States, what will be the benefits for organisations if they do embrace this culture, if they do make this change where they're not doing it right now?
The benefits that will come about are harder to measure. One of the problems being an academic is you can only you can only measure what you have data for. I know that organizations that have these systems that are active have people that stay in them, that enjoy their job, that do work, that feel an identity connection to their employer. And that kind of loyalty is fantastic. It's unbelievable. The culture beats strategy every day of the week, right? And so having that culture in your organization is the valuable carrot that most organizations should be going after, and the ones that are savvy do. There is also the avoidance of fines, penalties, and problems from government agencies and external bodies that can create lawsuits or different things. Harassments, for example, harassment's one of the top things. If you have one of these systems, human capital harassment is by far the highest reported thing in your system. It's the largest category by far. And you are able to get ahead of a lot of cultural problems with one of these systems.
Narinder Kapoor, are you hopeful that there will be change in the NHS, in particular after the Lucy Letby case, which we talked about at the start of this hour?
I think that, yes. I think the independent inquiry will obviously be good. And now that it's a statutory one where people will be obliged to give evidence, I think that probably some good will come out of that inquiry. But I think there should be an independent inquiry into whistleblowing in the NHS, across the NHS.
Anna Myers, director at the Whistleblowing International Network. What about turning this on its head, creating a legal duty, an obligation to blow the whistle? Is that something that could be done?
I'm a little in Kyle's camp that the law isn't the answer, but I do believe that the law is a very important element as our backup. I think if you put a duty on everyone, and you know, lawyers have always had duties, doctors have always had duties, doesn't mean that lawyers and doctors have never caused harm or been involved in wrongdoing. I think that we need to really focus on the organizational duties to listen as a better step, and that there are some legal elements there that I think would really make organizations sit up and pay attention. And I also think that what I'm seeing is greater understanding that it isn't just when people speak up and are pilloried in the press for doing so or really face some retaliation, there isn't the same assumption or watching from afar and saying, isn't that interesting? Or the research that academics are doing now is not just on what makes a good whistleblower or a bad whistleblower and why on earth do they put themselves in this situation. I see more and more people coming forward and more people coming up to step up and stand with them. We shouldn't just be relying on individuals, but they are gold and they can tell us where the problems are. So I do see definitely a feedback change. We're not just seeing this. People aren't assuming that there might not be a systemic problem anymore. They're not just seeing it as a single bad apple issue or a single problem. And I think organizations are starting to realize that they are in these stories start making people wonder what's going on structurally.
My thanks to our guests on the Real Story panel this week. They are Anna Myers, Director of Whistleblowing International Network, Carl Welsh, Assistant Professor at the George Washington University School of Business, and Narinder Kapoor, Professor of Neuropsychology at University College in London. Don't forget that every one of our previous editions of The Real Story is available either on our podcast feed or on the BBC Sounds app. My producers were Pandita Lorenz and Max Horbury. From them and from me, Sean Lay, thanks for listening, and please do join me again for the next edition of The Real Story.